Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, 100% employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
We've had a bit of a running theme this season, an intermittent theme, you might say, Jimmy,
yes.
If I could put it that way. There are currently, and it's been something that's been developing over probably, I guess you could say, decades, but really most notably, I think, in the last 8 to 10 years, there's a lot of different ways to be a chef
the
these
evolution
days.
Of the chef, the yeah. job of the chef.
The job of the chef means a lot of different things, and we're thrilled to hear from an old friend of ours recently, Chef Brian Bistrong, who has lived a lot of these different roles, and Brian is here in the studio. First of all, Brian, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to see you. For people who know Jimmy or know Brian, these guys used to work together. Brian used to be the chef of the Harrison restaurant.
Co-collaborators, having fun together.
Yes, which
a great time.
Which we didn't talk about this when we were having coffee before the show, but you know, I'd love at some point in this next 45 minutes or so to talk about that relationship.
Sure.
You know, I'm always interested in the chef de cuisine and chef owner or executive chef de cuisine, whatever you want to put, whatever titles.
Whatever.
But that relationship is really interesting. Brian was also the chef de cuisine, am I right on that, for David Boulay?
Chef de cuisine, David Boulay, yep.
Yep. And had his own restaurant in New York City, Braeburn, years ago. Then went west and did research and development in the test kitchen of Wolfgang Puck. And then most recently became the executive corporate chef of Dean & DeLuca.
Of Dean & DeLuca, yes.
That's quite a resume.
Yep.
Do you get tired just thinking about it?
I get dizzy.
It's very well-rounded.
So, Brian, first of all, just to sort of give, you know, this isn't inside the actor's studio, but just to give people the quick background, why don't you just briefly, you know, how did you start cooking? Where did you go to school? Just kind of give us the quick thumbnail on
sure.
your early years.
Well, I'm a Jersey boy, like a lot of chefs. I grew up near Princeton in the farms. First job was on a farm, but I have, you know, fond memories of my grandmother cooking, like a lot of people. And, you know, quickly got into the restaurants, washing dishes, then cooking. Then right out of high school, went to culinary school, went to CIA. And then I realized I was too young to start work and I wanted to have some more fun. So I went to Boston University and got my hotel degree and cooked up there as well. And then graduated and moved into New York City. And then my career really started booming. My first job in New York was at L'Espionnasse with Grey Kuntz and a whole
So right away people. Into the like super serious high end
yeah.
French oriented 4-star New York crucible.
Yeah. That was kind of, you know, the plan and like a lot of young chefs do. You work in the top, you know, 4-star New York Times, you know, places and kind of go from place to place. Back then it was, you know, Le Cirque was it when Danielle
yeah.
was at Le Cirque, and it was Lafayette with Jean George was there, and
yeah.
Quilted Giraffe,
you uh-huh. know,
that place.
Still
and,
the Quilted when you started.
It was, yeah.
Last few years of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, last few years.
Yeah.
And then L'Espionnasse was like kind of the new restaurant. Grey Kuntz moved over from the peninsula and had a lot of great talent in that kitchen. You know,
yeah.
Rocco Dispirito came out of there, Scott Bryan.
Sure.
Troy Dupuy, Floyd Cardoz was in the main kitchen when I started and then came over into L'Espionnasse.
Yeah.
So a lot of really great talent in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you, can we just talk, you know, one of the things I'd like to talk about during this show is you know, with where you are now, you're no longer in a situation where you have the adrenaline rush of those days, right? And yeah, and I remember we actually didn't we mention Brian a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
We did. You used to say to me when you were at the Harrison that you used to still, you know, a lot of chefs don't work Saturday night. That's not like a huge secret. A lot of executive chefs don't. And but you did at the Harrison, and you used to say to me that you wanted to see if you could still kind of hang and keep up with these cooks who were like, what's that about for you? Was that something that kind of went hand in hand with kind of developing a palate and a repertoire? Are those things sort of just completely intertwined for you?
I mean, for me, cooking is the release. Cooking for me is therapeutic.
You're talking about cooking like in
literally
service.
Cooking in service.
Yeah. Not like cooking at home.
No,
right.
Not at all. And I think, you know, working for David Boulay was a big part of that. You know, he is and was and is my mentor. And, he always cooked every service, you know, with us, and it's inspiring. He's coaching, he's leading, he's creating new dishes. And so, you know, that was for me what I should do.
Interesting.
Yeah. Cause I mean, listen, the Harrison was a great, great restaurant, lots of fun. But one of the fun things about it was, you know, we were fortunate. We had multiple chefs and had a lot of great experiences with each of them. And Brian was unique in a certain sense for like not just working on a Saturday night, but a lot of times the executive chef would work the pass or, you know, what you would say expediting, organizing the food to enter the dining room. And Brian, you know, he basically said, listen, I would rather cook than do that. And I was like, hey, if you can get a cook to do that the right way, more power to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he would just bang it out on the line. And
just
to me,
that
was amazing.
The Harrison was a restaurant that Jimmy owned initially in partnership with Danny Abrams. And it opened just after the terrorist attacks of 2001. It was in Tribeca in New York City.
8 blocks north of Ground Zero.
And it ran through, how long has it been now since you closed? You closed in 14?
Last day of 14.
Okay,
we did 14 years.
Okay, so that was the Harrison for people who maybe didn't know that restaurant.
Thank you.
Yeah. Not the hotel.
Yes. Often mistaken by other things.
So, Brian, you know, so you have these jobs.
Yeah.
You move out to California, and then you find your way, before the job you just took, you make a career transition, at least at the time, maybe. I don't – maybe you could tell. How do you make that decision to go from what we're talking about right now – kind of to cross this
to
divide
the
to the other side,
yeah.
Whatever you want to call it, to the R&D, to the corporate chef side. What's that? How long a process was that in your head? Was it a huge decision? Did it seem like a decision that had some finality attached to it? What was that sort of process like mentally to make that switch?
Well, I think there were a few factors. I mean, one, I'm getting older, and I didn't think I would get old. You know, but it's
well, you're not that old. You're still on the green side of 50.
But working behind the line day in and day out, it's a 20-year-old's work, 30-year-old, you know, work, and I've done it, and I need to do something else and use my gray matter more. So you know, there's that part of it, but also, you know, I'm married, I have a son, and I want to see my son grow up, and
right.
You know, running Boulay when I had Luca was, you know, 6 years old, I would take him to school in the morning, kind of like a zombie because I was working so late, and then that's when I saw him, you know.
Yeah.
And on the weekends or whenever I was off, you know, you kind of like have to buck up and stay awake for him. You know, we'd watch a movie and he'd always look at me in the eye and go, "Don't fall asleep, Dad." And I'm like, "Oh." So, you know, the hours are more conducive to life in general when you go kind of corporate. But still super interesting and still cooking, and if I want to go work in a restaurant, I still can do that, but not day in and day out and do the grind.
How does one get a job like that? Like, let's talk about the Puck job. How does it come on your? I mean, was there a headhunter? Did you go to them? Did you see a listing? And then I'd love to know a little. I mean, as much as you're able to tell of what the like what the interview and selection process and audition process is like for a job like that.
Well, I wasn't really looking for anything, but a headhunter who I'd known in Los Angeles called me and said, "Hey, I have a great job for you, you know, research and development with Wolfgang Puck, encompassing, you know, all his facets of his operation, which was fine dining, catering, and then he has, you know, this Wolfgang Puck Worldwide, which is more casual dining, airports, things like that." So there's a lot going on. Plus, he has consumer products like soup in the
sure.
So
frozen pizza,
yeah, frozen pizza. Yeah. You know. So I said, "Wow, that sounds really interesting." And he's like, "It's Monday through Friday." And I was like, "What? Monday through Friday days is like that's you don't find that too often." And
had you spent much time in LA before this?
Over the years, I have. Friends have migrated from New York to LA, and I've got to know it. And the food scene is. I mean, it's pretty amazing there.
Yeah, I just came back from there. It's great.
It's great. So so I sent him my resume, and Wolfgang looked at it. And then, you know, I get this call in the afternoon from this crazy Austrian man. And we started talking, and he's like, "You know, I want you to come down. I want you to meet the other people, and I want you to cook." So he just says, he said, "Just make a couple dishes." So, you know, they flew me down. I went. I did it at the Bel Air.
You were in the Bay Area at the time.
Yep. And, you know, flew down, went to the, they put me up at the Bel Air Hotel, not too shabby. I was like, I could get used to this.
Yeah.
They were super prepared, very professional. You know, I walked into, you know, the kitchen, and they had everything set up, which was to me a really good sign about the company itself. People were really helpful. And then I ended up making, you know, a whole tasting. I had a lot of time on my hands and to do it, because he was coming from Istanbul because he had just opened a restaurant there. So he landed and came into the hotel. And so I cooked for him and his chef de cuisine there, and cooked the meal and then sat down.
Do you remember what you made?
I know I made like a pasta dish that he really, really loved, which was a spaghetti with crab meat, jalapeno, some lemon zest, and some gremolata. Really simple, but tasty.
I mean, when you go into an interview situation like that with somebody, I mean, really, you know, maybe not for younger people who are listening, but really, in terms of this industry and its history, there's probably not a bigger, more influential person than Wolfgang Puck. There's probably not. So when you're walking into that scenario, A, what are the butterflies like? And B, what are you trying to show? You know, you just listed the breadth of what that company does.
Yeah.
What was the objective? Like, what were you trying to show? Or were you just trying to be like, "This is me and this is how I cook"?
You know, I wanted to show what I could cook on different levels. I did some things which were really casual and kind of family style, and other things that were really, you know, four-star things like boulet. So approachable food, provocative food for your mind.
Yeah.
You know, the way you said it, I mean, Wolfgang is huge. I guess I didn't think about that too much because I think I would have been a nervous wreck.
Even coming from, like, Boulet's kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah. You know.
How about
But I have to say, he was really, he's just a really nice guy. And so he made you feel very comfortable.
Did you think about or know what you wanted to cook in advance, or did you just arrive and do it?
No, I've done, you know,
like
for
when
a couple
you said
of
they
jobs.
Had some product laying around, you gave them an inkling of what you might be doing, or you just went cold?
No, I kind of knew what I was doing, and then I ad-libbed on some things just looking in their walk-ins, but I did know I wanted to do something somewhat Eastern European because of his roots.
Yeah.
And I did like a smoked braised beef cheek with like spetzel.
Uh-huh.
So definitely Eastern European.
Yum.
But then put like some Asian influence on it, kind of from Boulet, using like, I remember I made like this, it was like a carrot sesame dressing.
Yeah.
But it reminds me always of, like, you know, when you go to the Japanese restaurants back in the day and you get that house salad with the ginger dressing.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So good.
Even though it's made out of iceberg, it is so good. It's
exactly. That dressing. So that was my inspiration.
What, you know, you get that gig, you're there for what, about a year?
Well, about a year. Yeah.
You had this, "Oh, Monday through Friday, normal hours." Da, 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 da. What was the day to day like? And did you find yourself you know, going, this is pretty good.
You know, it was good. A lot of it, it was a brand new position for them. And also a brand new person coming in who hadn't been with Wolfgang for a long time. People are very loyal to Wolfgang. It's a great place to work.
There are people who have been with him for
years.
Decades.
Yes, decades.
Yeah.
And in fact, the gentleman that I was working with, kind of who would oversee my day-to-day, had been with Wolfgang for 20 years, you know, Matt Benzavinga, an amazing, amazing chef, really good guy. He ran all of the catering, and this was kind of his pet project. And unfortunately, he was sick.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to have known him. He passed away six months after I worked, and that was really hard. I'm like a son to Wolfgang, so it was difficult times, you know, for the Wolfgang Puck family.
Yeah,
and so, you know, there wasn't a lot. Sometimes there wasn't enough direction on where they wanted to go, and so some days it could be like I didn't know what to do,
right?
You know, and I'm like just messing around working with stuff, but I didn't feel productive personally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
but even on those days, was there a few little gems that came out of it that?
Yeah, I mean,
when you look back on it,
I look back like I mean, I worked on some really interesting things for consumer products, which I never even thought I would be doing, like products that you'd be seeing in the supermarkets. Working and developing new soups, working on snack foods, so working on chips with no gluten. Like I made these chips made all out of seeds, which were really cool, and that was exciting, those parts.
How did you have to change your, rewire your thinking, right, to go from food designed to be produced, over on a certain time frame in for service, right, which was your whole life up to then,
yeah,
to things where, there were... that you talk about things that maybe would end up in, like a bag or a can, which really in a lot of ways opens up the world in some ways and also, but closes it in certain ways.
Closes other doors.
Yeah. What was that mental transition like?
You have to slow down for sure.
What do you mean?
Well, in the kitchen, you run a restaurant.
Right.
Yeah. Restaurants are a la minute.
A la minute.
That's it.
I mean, also it's like every restaurant kitchen I've ever ran, it's like, you walk in, it's triage.
Yeah.
It's like you talk to your sous chef. Is everybody here? Okay, good. Check.
Is all the food here?
Is all the food here? Did everything show up? What's broken?
Is the hot water work?
It's like the checklist before a plane takes off.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you're like, all right, we have a good beginning, but the day's not over yet.
One of my favorite lines ever, a million years ago, and I've mentioned it to a few pastry chefs. They haven't taken exception to it, but this is a long time ago. I was at a Christmas party, and Wayne Harley Brackman, who had been at the time was the pastry chef at Mesa Grill, I think is still billed as the pastry chef at Porterhouse, if I'm not mistaken, Michael Amonico's restaurant. And we were talking, and I was just starting to be around people who do what you guys do. And we were talking about chefs versus pastry chefs. And he said to me, he goes, I'll break it down for you. He said, chefs are surgeons. Pastry chefs are pharmacists. And I said, what does that mean? I really had no idea what he meant. He goes, well, chefs are surgeons. Like it's intense. It's triage. It's constantly adjusting to what's happening in front of you. And pastry chefs, you measure, you weigh. It's very precise, and it takes place in a much calmer environment under different circumstances, even though you're in the same physical space, more or less. True?
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
I mean, the pastry kitchen would be my refuge in restaurants that I've worked before. When I would kind of want to get away from my crazy family, I'd go hide in the pastry and eat a bowl of ice cream.
And I think chef basically means chief, and pastry chefs really embrace that in the sense of, well, why don't you fix this for me, chief? Why don't I tell you and you deal with it, chief? They'll take the credit when it's all going great. And, listen, maybe most kitchens are set up where the chef is the last stop, fix this for me or, something like that.
So before we go to our break, why don't we do the transition to your current gig? And then when we come back, we'll talk kind of about what's going on there.
Sure.
So how does Dean and DeLuca come into your life and how do you get the gig?
So I'm in LA and one of my old chefs calls me and was like, do you know any real estate agents, commercial real estate agents in LA? And I said, yeah, of course. He goes, because we're thinking about coming out to LA. And I didn't know at the time he was working for Dina Luca. He was working for Cook Shop. And I was like, Cook Shop's coming out to LA? He goes, oh, no, I'm working with Dina DeLuca now. And I'm like, oh, wow. They were amazing at one time. Anyhow, you know, the managing director comes out with one of VP of Ops, and I meet him in Venice at Giusta.
Uh-huh. You know, which I haven't been, but I know it, yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
And I pegged them immediately.
I can feel sunshine you know, on my skin as I just think about it, but go ahead.
But I pegged them. I mean, they're getting out of this Uber, two guys in, like, suits, jackets, and they're like, no one wears a suit jacket.
Right.
Like, they're definitely from Dina DeLuca. And they're looking, like, out, because it's a little sketchy. You have Gold's Gym across the street and, like, homeless people, you know, camped out. And they're like, where are you taking us? And I said, trust me. We go into Giusta, and they're like, wow, great, you know. And I want them to see it, because it's, like, for me, it's a modern delicatessen.
Right.
L.A. style.
Yeah.
But then we just started talking about Dina DeLuca, and I was like, I have really fond memories of Dina DeLuca when I moved to New York, and that's where every chef shopped, and they had all the best breads and meats and fish.
It was them and Balducci's.
Yeah, it was them and Balducci's.
A mecca.
Well, if you go all the way back, I mean, if you talk to, like, Karen Waltuck about the early days of Chanterelle, mm-hmm. before it was even Dina DeLuca, she got her cheeses from Giorgio DeLuca from I believe his cheese shop.
His cheese shop. That's
before there was Dean and DeLuca.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the heritage is sick.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so I was, you know, that was my first time going there when I went to New York, and then I was just kind of reminiscing with these guys, and I said, you know, then it kind of lost its way. They sold it to Leslie Rudd, and it just changed. And but then there's a new owner, and they're putting new blood, you know, capital, everything into it. And I was just kind of talking to them, and they said, you know, we're looking for an corporate executive chef, and we just start talking.
Yeah.
And one thing led to another.
And then here you are.
Here I am.
Congratulations.
Okay. Thank you.
So with that cliffhanger, we're going to come back after the break and talk to Chef Brian B. Strong, who's our guest today, about the day-to-day life of being the corporate executive chef of Dina DeLuca. And we're going to do something we never do. We always say we're a chef show. We're not a food show. But we have food in the studio. And I'm going to do my best Matt Lauer impression. Or
will it be Al Roker?
And talk about that when the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew comes right back.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years, and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife, Charlie, started Bob's Red Mill almost four decades ago. Today, they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his four children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We've been talking with corporate executive chef for Dean and DeLuca, Brian B. Strong. And before we pick up our conversation, I'm just going to pick up on the spot we just heard. We came in today, Jimmy, and David, our engineer. David, I haven't thanked you the last week or two. I'm so sorry.
Thank you, David.
All is forgiven.
Thank you very much. I'm going to thank you now. I don't believe anyone listens to the last minute of any podcast, so I'm going to thank David in the middle of the podcast. And anyway, we have new headphones today, which, you know, no one listening would... Ah, David, I should thank you more often. We get sound effects now.
Too cool.
First one's free.
Anyway, we have these new headphones. They just sound, I don't even know, Jimmy. It's like, we went from black and white to color, yes. Audibly.
Yes. So I know we're in Technicolor.
Audibly. And Katie, the executive director of Heritage, was here, and she said, you can thank Bob's Red Mill for that. So Bob's Red Mill, thank you. Another thank you from the people here at Heritage Radio. Yes, give it up.
Well,
give it up.
Thank you for the headphones, but thank you for what you do. We love what you do.
Yes, and we love what you do. So thank you, Bob's Red Mill. Back to, I'm sorry, the applause really threw me off. what else can we do, David? I want to get weird now. No, we'll save that for next week.
We'll have a pre-production meeting before.
Yes,
next week
we'll plan it out. We'll have goofy sound effects. Brian, tell us about the scope of what you're doing for Dean and DeLuca.
Daunting.
What's the job description? Like, what are the bullet points on the, job description?
I mean, anything that touches food prepared.
Make it up. Get it done.
Yeah.
So prepared is the umbrella. Well, that's your jurisdiction.
So prepared food. So working in the case, we call it grab and go. So prepared food that you can just grab and go.
Yeah.
Catering. So we do a lot of catering. We do a lot of drop-off business catering has been our bread and butter. Yeah. But now we're getting into social catering, and we did an event, a promo event last night for all these catering directors and events planners. And next day we received a new party from that one party. Because people don't know that we do, you know, hors d'oeuvres and cocktail receptions and dinners. And people were like, pretty blown away, and that was kind of a unveiling of our new hors d'oeuvres and things like that. So we work on that. You know, some of these new projects will have cafes, so so they'll I will have get some restaurant work, and then we also have smaller units, so not big markets where you go shopping like retail, but we have like the New York Times building, so more quick lunch, not full service restaurant, but you know, sandwiches, soups, you know, very casual food you can eat in or take out. So there's a lot going on.
And how does what you do get translated to the, you know, to the brick and mortar level? To the case. How's it happen? Give me the little movie montage where we see, like, you know, the movie terms, it would be like, you know, the article, old, you know, the thing, the copy going from the writer's typewriter to the newspaper hitting the step. How's that go for this?
You know, I have ideas for food. I have a great team. We have a commissary for Dean and DeLuca. And so I'll make a dish with my executive chef of the commissary, kind of show him what I want. And it's easy to make a pound of salad, but then when you have to make 50 pounds, it changes. So we'll work on that process. Then we get the recipe. Then we have to make the recipe so it runs corporate, because this recipe will go to Charlotte, will go to Georgetown, because we have other markets.
Yeah.
So it's put into the computer system. We use this program Chef Tech. Then you have to get a PLU.
Is Chef Tech exactly?
Chef Tech is like a restaurant-based program or kitchen-based program where you can do your inventory, you can do your purchasing, you can do your recipe development. It does it all. And so that we use that, and that talks with all the different stores.
Do you use it for all the functions that you listed, or do you use it for just one or two of the functions?
We don't use it to its fullest capability, but we use it for
like.
We don't purchase through it, but we put like our inventories through it and our receivables into it.
Mm-hmm.
We can purchase some products through it, which updates our pricing, which is quite nice online.
Got it.
So then if you get the recipe developed, you have the verbiage, you have the signage, you have the PLU, then it goes to the store, they're ready for it. Then you have to teach the chefs, okay, you know, how you transfer it from aluminum pan onto a plate and make it look, refresh it, and it goes into the case, and then you sell it, and there you go.
And when you say teach the chefs, do you sort of go around and do like a demo and a...
Yes, that's where I was yesterday, all day yesterday morning, working with the chefs and working with the people that work the case.
Because, yeah,
you know, you're working also with people that aren't, you know, who aspire to be chefs at Boulay or Levin Madison, things like that.
You have,
you know, a different caliber of cook, maybe not even a cook, because you also need salespeople, you know.
Sure.
They don't necessarily know how to cook, but they need to know how to interact with the customers.
Right.
But you work with them on how to dress up the plates, and then, you know, we do a lot of tasting in the store, so
yeah,
give the customers a taste of something.
Yeah.
You know, you put it in your mouth, and then
yeah,
you're going to sell it.
When you imagine, you know, when you're in a restaurant and you conceive a dish, right, it's, you know, even, gosh, you could take almost the full breadth of restaurants in this country, right, or the world almost. And there's a, you know, it's going to go on a plate, it's going to go up on the pass, it's going to a table, there's going to be a knife and fork or whatever utensil you use in wherever you are. What do you have in your head a picture of where this food is being consumed? Like when you're imagining dishes, do you imagine like this is a lunch thing? This is someone sitting at a desk in Soho pulling it out of a, like, do you imagine your customers and where they are and how, what setting and in what circumstance? Just, I mean, logistically, what kind of, are they eating it right out of the container? Out of the container. Do you have to think in this way?
I do. And sometimes unconsciously I'm thinking about it. I mean, because I'll use a previous packaged, part of packaging that they use. And, I'm like, this isn't work.
Yeah.
And so it's not conducive to eat. You know, you have these boxes that fold, and how do you get into it? How do you
cut? Yeah, yeah.
So then you look at, you know, new packaging. We also look at packaging that's green.
Yeah.
We've moved all our, you know, all our drop-off catering is all just, you know, biodegradable.
Yeah.
So we look at that as well.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Is it terribly different? Like, I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, throughout your chef days in restaurant kitchens, you would conceive or conceptualize menu items, perhaps not just thinking about yourself, but thinking about the guest and the guest experience as well. So if that's correct, you know, is there a difference in how you approach it in this atmosphere?
I think you have to think about, it's a little less ego.
My point was in that.
Yeah. In working with Dean and DeLuca, you need crowds pleasers, and, you know, these people are having lunch every day, and so it's not, you know, it's sustenance. It needs to be healthy.
Yeah.
Needs to be delicious. It needs to be, you know, affordable.
Yeah.
So I think about that, and, you know, sometimes you'd be like, man, you look at this one salad maybe that's been there for years. You're like, man, this is so dated, and this needs to come off. And then you take it off, and
yeah,
people are like, where is that, you know,
yeah,
that pasta salad? You know, and then you look at like your sales history, and you're like, "Oh my God, what did I do?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And put that back on. And
all right, so before we get too close to our end point, why don't you tell us a little? You brought some food to the studio.
I brought some food.
Front burner,
yeah,
first. So why don't you tell us? These are things that you've developed.
Yeah.
What do we have here?
So the first one is chicken salad. So I wanted to make a chicken salad that isn't mayonnaise based.
Uh-huh.
And for me, it's just...
Was that for health reasons or because a lot of people are asking to not?
I think a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But for me, I love roasted chicken.
I mean,
you know. So it's just rotisserie chicken, and then we break it down in no particular way, just naturally.
Just pull it apart.
Just pull it apart.
Right.
But when we're roasting it, we put all this mirepoix of different vegetables underneath the chicken, so all the drippings fall onto the vegetables, and the vegetables are roasted as well. And it's also extremely simple. It's like one stop, you know, it's like the one pan pickup, right? You put everything into the oven or on the rotisserie, and then you take it out, mix it all together,
right?
Maybe add a little sherry vinegar to it, but you have your oil is the grease from the chicken, cool. You know, the chicken fat.
Now, is that cilantro on top?
No, that's just some parsley. Celery leaf. I'm a all big right. fan of celery leaf. It has celery root.
And are these all peppers. Items that one would find in the case?
All these are in the case.
These are, what do you call today. It? Case items? What do you call it?
Yeah.
Case items. Can I taste it?
Yeah.
I'll use my fingers.
No worries.
Even though nobody would have known, right? But
the next one is just
stupid, Andrew.
Thanks for sharing, Andrew.
So stupid.
Then just, you know, a salad, it's citrus season. So some blood orange, roasted, chioga beets, shaved fennel, mint, little jalapeno, just refreshing, healthy.
It all smells so good.
Then to have, just all different roasted wild mushrooms, again, with some celery root,
calling parsnips. That a salad as well?
Salad or side vegetable it could be used for, and then last is just, you know, we got some broccoli de Chico from County Line, which is a great farm in Marin. So orchietti, broccoli de Chico, sausage, little Calabrian chili. I mean, right. Kind of classic Puglia.
Yes, you were very, when before we came back from the break, I said, did you develop all these dishes? And you said, well, I'm not going to take credit for the broccoli, putting broccoli, sausage, and orchietti together. Yeah.
But just tasty. And that's there's a perfect dish.
I got to do my Matt Lauer. That is delicious. No, but honestly, all these dishes are yummy.
But that's a dish is... It's a classic. You can't mess with it. It's delicious.
Yeah.
That's goddamn and, good.
You know,
although this is a very minor thing, but I like that everything is kind of cut to the scale of the orchietti, which you often don't see in that dish. A lot of times you get pieces of broccoli that are, you know, a little unwieldy.
That's probably a little back of my anal retentive French.
Yeah, well, also that's the difference between putting a knife and a fork on the table or a plastic knife and a fork in a bag, right. You know.
And then what's this?
What's this yumminess what's this over here?
Oh, this is amazing. So this is the focaccia fino from our baker, Kamel. Sachi, and it's
amazing.
Super light.
Oh my god!
It's got like tons of olive oil.
I just want to, yeah. When you say super light, this thing is, I don't know, 2 feet
it
long.
It looks like a baguette, but it feels like the most beautiful, light, airy piece of focaccia you've ever been offered.
Yeah.
If you've ever picked up an Echo shoe in a shoe store and were like, how is that shoe that light? That's what just happened here. Sorry to compare. I don't mean to compare.
That's a good analogy.
It's a good analogy, yeah. Right?
But, okay. Thank you know,
very
so
much. I'm going to...
We're using this bread now. I'm developing a whole bunch of paninis and breakfast sandwiches. And this bread is just perfect for it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's addicting. I brought some...
Do you sell wholesale?
We should.
We'll talk about that after the show.
Great stuff. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You know, more and more people are taking jobs like this job, right? I feel bad. I forgot his name. The chef from Franny's in Brooklyn took right. the Blue Apron gig not mm-hmm. that long ago. I'm sorry. I'm finishing my bread. But you've taken this job. Joe Murphy, I think, is the...
Joe Murphy works with us.
Yeah. I think most recently, restaurant-wise, was with John George's group. Years ago, he was with the Gotham.
David
pastry Burba. Chef. You know, it seems like, oh, this is an avenue that's out there for people, right? But, I haven't really talked to that many. This is the longest conversation I've probably had about it. This cannot possibly be a job for most chefs, right? I think you probably have to be a particular kind of, you have to have certain corporate communication skills. You have to be able to kind of dress up and do meetings. You have, right? I mean, what is it? What kind of skills, social and professional, does one need if they're contemplating a transition like this?
Well, I mean,
because it can't just be enough to be a great cook.
No, I mean, yeah, like you said, I mean, you need social skills. I think you need experience, and I've been very fortunate in varied experience. You know, working in fine dining with Boulez, doing some R&D with Wolfgang. But also, you know, when I worked with Boulez, I did a lot of work with Wegmans, people don't know.
Yeah.
Wegmans is an amazing supermarket based in Rochester. So I did have some retail experience and knowledge already there.
Yeah.
And it's always piqued my interest.
Right.
It's nice to cook in a restaurant, but you feed a lot more people in stores. And I think now food is changing so much that you can get the same quality food from a restaurant that you can in a store.
Right.
And it's, I think it's just the beginning.
So you see this aspect of the, you see this as a growing.
I do.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of these quick service restaurants now you see, the Diggins and the Sweetgreens and all that, where you're getting great quality product, high volume, and much more affordable. But also, I mean, we have, you know, thousands of people coming through the store a day, and we touch them at lunch. And then if we can capture them and they say, wow, this is pretty amazing food, they'll come back for dinner. I mean, they don't go out to dinner for dinner every night.
Or use you guys for catering or start, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, and then you, it's funny, then it all comes around, right? Then all of a sudden you're kind of doing a service again. In a way.
Correct.
Yeah. I would imagine that's a very satisfying part of the job for you.
It's fun.
To be able to...
Yeah. To go do an event.
Stick your toe in again and get a little taste of that. So we're almost out of time. We got to take a minute or two, though. We didn't spend as much as possible, but you guys used to work together.
We did.
And we were sitting before the show. Jimmy and I always kind of prep for the show at the Swallow Cafe around the corner. And you had asked if you, you know, where do you guys meet? Could I join you guys?
Yeah.
And at one point, you two were talking.
It
and
was like our, it was our Tuesday meeting, right?
It was
our Tuesday meeting that we did for a few years together. Yeah,
you two did. So at one point, you guys were just talking. I just sat back and watched. What's it like to see, wait, what comes... what comes up for you guys when you see each other, having been in the trenches together?
I mean, me, it's seeing an old friend and an old partner. You know, I thought when I worked at the Harrison, I really kind of felt like I was finally developing as a chef with kind of my own style. You know, Jimmy and I have different backgrounds in how we've cooked, and so we kind of approach food differently. And when we talk about dishes, it was really cool to develop them together because of our different experiences.
Like a Lennon McCartney sort of thing. Like, just different.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that.
Well, I just mean in terms of, you know, very different points of view coming together.
Yeah, totally. I mean, for me.
Complementing each other. I mean, I could totally see that. I mean, you come from a very sort of high-end background.
Yeah, it could be a push-pull, you know. It could easily be a push-pull, but... You know, I mean, where's the fun in that, first of all? And then I kind of thought about it, like I said earlier, you know, most people would think if you had a restaurant for 15 years and you had 3 or 4 or 5 chefs, that'd be a pain in the ass. And yeah, it is, you know, change is a pain in the neck, but also change is the newness, you know? So opening up with Joe Campanaro, who, you know, Joey and I, we can finish our own sentences. We don't have to speak about food so much. I mentioned something, he mentioned something, and it was really, you know, it was very... I've known Joe forever. It's very simple. Brian, I really had never met him. I'd never hung out with him. But, you know, through the process, and, you know, this was also me sort of coming of age as a chef, or mostly as a restaurant owner in this context. I kind of thought about it like as a blank canvas that Brian could paint on the way he wanted to. So I would say, do you get me, and do you get this restaurant, and do you get what we're trying to do here? And if so, what do you want to do with it? You know, so it's perhaps a little bit more of a liberating approach than some owners and chefs have with each other. You know, if a dish sold, like to Brian's point, and sold really well, I'd say take that fucker off the menu. You know, like I know as a chef, it sucks to cook the same thing 400, 800, 900 times. If we get a lot of pushback, we'll bring it back at another time. But, you know.
You would really do that if something sold well enough? Like
he was more resistant
take it
than
out
I was.
Yeah, I probably was more resistant.
You wanted to keep it because it was.
I mean, you know. We
it
are
seemed
in the
like the responsible
business,
thing to do.
Right? We have to make people happy.
The guest wants consistency, but there's a fine line between the consistency and the enthusiasm. Like, in other words, if the cooks and the chefs who are supposed to be creative and doing this repetitive thing over and over again, they can lose the spark because the repetition takes over. You know, you lose the creativity when you employ the repetition. So there has to be this sort of mechanism where you can gain and gather all of it at the same time, which is like something that I was really interested in. How do we all get what we want out of this thing? Like, I never thought of the Harrison. This is weird, but the thing was, I never wanted to be near or own a restaurant that was all things to all people. I just wanted you to think that we had exactly what you wanted.
Right.
You know, I understand that's a catch-22.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But one of the ways that you do it is you just keep kicking the can down the field, and you do it in these ways where everybody is kind of brought along with it instead of you know, cast aside.
Yeah. Well, this really flew, but we got to get out of the studio. There's another show behind ours. Brian B. Strong, old friend, executive corporate chef for Dina De Luca.
Yeah, good to see you.
Bringer, thanks for having me. It was
bringer,
a lot of fun.
Bringer of yummy samples.
Yes.
Thank you for being here today.
Pleasure.
And Jimmy and I are actually going to, one of us is going to be out of town next week, so we'll pick out a fun rerun, and then we'll be back 2 weeks with hopefully something very timely and entertaining for everybody. With that, I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
We'll see you next time on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.